before. Maybe it's not mine. Our chance, we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass may have in the middle of it. Grass may have in the middle.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. This is George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off this evening. Well, we want to welcome you back. We're into doing live presentations now from Austin, Texas. And I'm George Butler, co-host along with Charlotte Littlefield of The Secret Truth. We've been broadcasting for well over 6 years. I would say we started in November 2006. And November 1st, 2006, so November the 1st of this year will be 7 years in the broadcast industry. We tried to be very diligent in our information over the years and careful about portraying things as they really are. In this particular genre, we're part of the alternative news. So we have to be careful that we don't make statements that we can't back up, even though there are times when the statements that we make, you're never going to find the evidence to fully back up all of our statements. Tonight, the first hour, we're going to speak about a paper that was done back in the 70s, and it came out of the Stanford Research Institute. Joseph Campbell was one of the authors of it, and several other people. Margaret Mead was another one. And basically, the name of it was Changing Images of Man. And basically, what they came up with was an idea of how to transform, if not to create a paradigm shift from this old thinking, this old industrial revolution thinking, to a new post-industrial information age thinking, new world order age. This is what they're trying to do now, and we're in the throes of experiencing many of the media, hype, books, philosophical ideas that are underlying this change that is trying to be created. The change has to do with trying to put forth and trying to convince people that they're rising to a whole new conscious level. And this new consciousness is going to bode well for themselves and for the world. But also, many of the ideas incorporated in this new way of thinking have to do with a very collective state. Now, if you'll go and download that document, Changing Images of Man, you'll find it on our site at thesecrettruth.com. But go ahead and download that PDF file, and then come back and listen to our program and our comments, and then go back and read this document. You can download it for free and read it, and it's really an insightful document in the sense that these are some of the movers, shakers in sociology and philosophy, and like Joseph Campbell, he had a lot to do with myth, the power of myth. There was a whole series of PBS programs that featured him talking about myth and how they change men and change societies and change the world. So this is actually what this paper was first put forward to do, was to create incubate the world into a new way of thinking and being. The New Age movement, the humanistic psychology movement, Maslow, these are some of the ideas and people that came out of the 60s and 70s, and that had a great effect on today. The hierarchy of needs was Maslow's hierarchy, and part of the humanistic psychology movement. What was interesting about this humanistic psychology movement was that it didn't go over initially when they first started proffering this to the public. The minute that they renamed it Humanistic Potential Movement and started with a plethora of differing books and so forth about individuals increasing their individual power and so forth and their might, and they started appealing to that old thing called the ego state. This is when they started having success. I'm okay, you're okay, the power of positive thinking, psycho-cybernetics. There was just a slew of books. Then I happened to read most of these when I was in my late teens, early 20s. Well, I read those before I was 17, most of those books. So I not only experienced this particular period, but I began to read about it at the beginning of the, you could say, the movement there. I didn't know what I was being caught up in at the time, because I was just, you know, like I said, I was like 14, 15 when I started reading in this area, and I was really mesmerized and interested in sociology. Vance Packard wrote a slew of books like The Wastemakers and The Status Seekers. In fact, he coined the term White Anglo-Saxon Protestant back in the 50s. Late 50s, early 60s. So he was a sociologist that, you know, some people call him pop psychologist or whatever sociologist. But he had some very, very important books that I was able to read and glean from those the very best ideas that I could. Well, you know, like Future Shock came along later and these kinds of books. Today, we are in the throes of a transformation by the world movers and shakers. You could say that these are the Illuminati, some people have called them. The Olympians is another term that many of the monarchs of England and Great Britain and the European monarchies like to call themselves and visualize themselves to be. These are people that have taken ego to a new level. And they do seriously believe themselves to be godlike, you know. That seems to be the problem in today's world, is that these people that believe themselves as gods are trying to put forward a view to where they can seed into everyone those same ideas of everyone being godlike. So when you start taking a look at this document that you can download off of our site, and again, go into thesecrettruth.com and download that. We'll make that available to you. This first hour, like I said, we're going to cover changing images of man. And then we're going to go into some current news during the second hour. And we're going to sprinkle throughout this current news in the second hour some dynamic ideas. I'm going to speak a little bit on my idea about what I call money sorcery, and to give an idea, to give you a bit of an idea, so to speak, about how these ideas are actually, it's like magic, see? It's like sorcery that these people that are at the very top of this whole level of world management view themselves as great sorcerers or great magicians, and they're going to come up with these great ideas that are used to control and to enslave us and to make us bend to their will. See, they are the great gods. We're the great peasants, the great masses out here, and we must perform on their command. They're building a very hideous future state, and I can see it. People like Alex Jones and others that have looked into this and studied it can see this great, hideous, devilish, evil future state for mankind, for a world state, you could say. This new world order, so to speak, is what some have called it before. But there are a few people in the study of this that can see the hideousness of it and the evil of it. We're not fooled by these faces that people put on there, you know, themselves. It's like walking down a Hollywood set where it's like a Wild West set, and you see the fronts of the buildings, and they look pretty good with on movie film and so forth. You go in behind those fronts, and there's nothing there. They're just the front, the facade. Then that's what a facade is of a building. It's the front of the building. And that's what the world is really about, is that people place upon their face and upon their demeanor, much more of a facade than the real expression of who they really are. The core self, I believe, is still there. In this worldly dynamic of worldly things, there are biblical statements in there that say it better than anything or anyone has ever said it before. But these worldly ideas get in us, see. But how do they get in us? They're the spoken word through audio, through our ears, into our minds, and then through the eye, which is the overwhelming influence through objects and imaging, and ideas come into us. I've always stated in the past that a stream of light is an idea. So that stream of light coming into us, conveying to us an object or what we have learned previous about, is stored in our mind. So is an idea an abstraction or not? I truly, in my own system of thinking, I believe that it is not truly abstract, but it is real. It's a real stream of light. It has been stored. It is confluencing along with other previously streams of light and comparing these other streams of light with what it has contained within it. I view the mind sort of like these streams of light are stored, and then it's like film. They're overlaid with each other, and they're saying, well, what is common to these, to this film strip and this film pick? See what I mean? This particular frame. So you can say, what frame of a, looking at a salt shaker, you say, that's a frame of a salt shaker. Now, 2 years ago, I looked at the frame, and I have a frame of a salt shaker, and they look pretty similar. There's white material inside and so forth. I sprinkle it on the table. It looks the same. I taste it. It tastes the same. So it must be a salt shaker, see. So I believe that this is the way the mind is comparing continuously. There are many things that are going on in the background that we're not really conscious about, and processes that the body and the mind are undertaking on a subconscious basis that we're not always fully conscious about. This paper put out, the Changing Images of Man paper that we're getting back to here, was to put forward the idea that man is at the end of this post-industrial and is beginning this new information age, and we're going into the future to some new emerging image of man. Now, what they're trying to put forward is some new emerging image of man that is much more new age. In other words, it's what some have termed cosmic humanism. Is that we're part of nature, and then nature is part of us, and that we're all one together. See, and I fought by these people. They fought me because I'm still clinging to this thing called individualism or whatever. See. And they're totally have given up on the idea of individualism, because individuals who have a very strong sense of self are much more difficult to control, see. It's like, for example, when our new nation was just beginning to come together, there were men out there that had been well-educated and looked into philosophy and politics and money and banking and all this for years before they finally begin to coalesce their ideas, coalescing together and confluencing together to form this new nation called America, the United States of America, so to speak. Well, many had learned in their own background and the basis of what their thoughts were, based much of their thinking, political thinking, on what we would term a natural law. Idea or basis. And from that natural law would spring forth natural rights. But that's saying that somehow then that men can form governments, but those governments can give you human rights, but they can't give you natural rights, see? So what is a higher level of law than natural law over man's law, or positive law, positivism? You know, natural law is above what men can do and say and promulgate and invent and write. That's why it has precedent. And it had precedent in these men like Jefferson and George Mason and you know, James Madison, all John Madison, all these people. They were thinking in this area of natural law, natural rights. How can we say that the crown does not give us anything, that the natural rights come from the natural law, which is embedded in the very creation of which we are all subject to? But they also said that individuals should be protected, see? This new idea that's coming forth, though, with this changing images of man, is that we're all part of a big collective, and that we're all part of this great big universe. And it's trying to override the idea of individualism, see? You must, the new world order, the new, you could say, manipulators and the new slave masters of this great new plantation that they visualize as the new world order of the earth, right? It can't countenance individualism, because individuals would come up together and collectively come together, but as individuals, voluntarily, by the way. And that's where there's a difference here. The coercion of forcing these people together in a collective, it takes force. They're trying to bring these people together along lines of ecological, you know what I mean, protection and things like this, and it is working. But it is not an ecological dynamic that we're really talking about. We're talking about that ecological dynamics are political dynamics. So environmentalism has more to do with political thought and control than it does with keeping the environment sound and clean. Conservation was a word way long before the word environmentalism came along. And it meant that you should protect nature, and you should take care of nature, and you shouldn't, you know, throw trash and trash it out, things like this. So these are ideas that were far before this word called environmental or ecological. These are very, very powerful ideas that have been seeded in from the nurseries, the kindergartens, on up through all of the schools into the minds of our people. And so they dictate their wills. So they're acting out other people's, you know, ideas about ecological and environmentalism issues. If they sit down and think about it, they'll start developing an individual idea of who they are and what they think needs to be done. And that would stand outside of these systems of conditioning and programming and education. See, we have a total wrong idea of education in this country. And that's, a friend of mine gave me a book just recently, and had to do with neuro-linguistic programming. And it's a fine book, and I started thinking about that book. And I want to thank David for giving me that book, because it opens up more ideas for me to think about. And one of the ideas that I begin to think about concerning this neuro-linguistic programming is, for that to work, there has to have been previous teachings and education and defining of certain terms. So everyone has been conditioned through mandatory education, universal education, and we're forced to go there to school, say. Only here recently, in the last few decades, has homeschooling risen and begin to be something that's very powerful force in American society. And there it came out of the religious groups. More power to them. They should teach their children what they won't talk to their children. The public schools today, and they're well-meaning in many ways, but they're not really aware of the function that they're you know, carrying, that they really affect. The function that they're attaining, you could say, for the New World Order is one of a conditioned, regimented state with certain definitions of certain ideas and a collective idea that should be paramount over the individual. So we've got to all come together. This is what they say, the New World Order, the New Age, cosmic humanism type group, But we're all God, they say. Yeah, are we? So if we're all God, then why do we have so many troubles, see? A God would be all-knowing and about themselves and the world and so forth, and it would not transgress then. Human nature is rife with examples of individuals transgressing against other individuals and causing harm to other individuals through murder or whatever and so forth. Hurtful acts against individuals, against other individuals. What is that all about? No one had been able to solve those kinds of problems. The theology that is most relevant to trying to overcome these kinds of problems has been the Christian idea, the New Testament, the ideas out of the New Testament. These are the golden divine ideas. And those kinds of ideas of love thy neighbor as thyself and so forth. And above all, Charlotte Littlefield and I've always, we have as a slogan for our program about forgiveness. And what we mean there is that when you can begin to forgive yourself and others, then you can begin to come out of this worldly dominated slavery of thought slavery that has been educated into you through the worldly ideas of which most people are suffering in a state of. Most individuals are not free. Most individuals are slaves to ideas. And in this slave state, they are not able to see themselves because they are caught up inside of this feel system of thinking. What I talk about to try to help people to overcome these slave states, so to speak, is forgiveness. Only through forgiveness can we attain a new world order, a divine world order. We're not going to attain it through any kind of education and knowledge-based system. There must be a change, an emotional change, a change in spirit, a change in direction, a metanoia must be undergone, a change in the way that you're thinking about yourself and the world and on a different basis. That's what metanoia means, a change of direction. If you're going down the path of evil, you need to change and get back here to goodness. If you're out here robbing people and doing criminal acts, you need to get back here to non-criminal acts and acts of charity. We're continually bogged down because we're overwhelmed by these worldly inputs. Today, television and movies and so forth are overwhelming in the nature of overwhelming us. And then through those ideas, they're playing out through our will. So all we're doing is parroting others' wills, say, others' influences. But they're not our own in most cases. To attain the real self, we must be able to see that we're suffering in a state, see, of this false self, this ego state, see. And in that ego state, we can't see it because the delusion that we're caught up in hides the fact that we are in a deluded state of ego, of submerged in that ego, and we're compartmentalized within that ego compartment, you could say. We can't stand outside of it. To really overcome our state, our fallen state, and it's not an elevated state. Now, you can go out here and people are continuously pushing. I see all the time these paradigmical changes and this new great transformation. Oh, that word you see everywhere. There's going to be some great transformation. And that transformation is going to be the end all to everything. I mean, that's the panacea. All you have to do is get on board, sign up on this, go on this website, and you're going to realize. But it's all ego-based, usually. All of these great solutions to the world's problems are some kind of new way to think, new way to say something. That's what that neurolinguistic programming is. A new way to decipher what people are saying and then string a series of words together that can influence others more effectively. Tim. The ideas out there are worldly ideas. They're not divine. Because men have a nature, a human nature, that is not divine. I'm sorry about the New World Order here and what they're saying about the New Age or the New Agers. I'm sorry, people, New Agers. We're not divine. Go out and show me that where people are getting divine and stop. And, you know, they're saying, everyone is saying from this new paradigmical shift group, we're going to attain some great new thing. I don't see it. I do not see it. Individual by individual is what real change. That's where real change has to occur. When you start talking about some great movement, or someone has written this great book, and you just read the book, and that's going to be it. No, that's not it. It's not about a technique, okay, that can change the world. It's about you changing and being able to see how wrong you have been. So this know thyself thing that Socrates taught, who really knows that? Very few people are ever really aware of how little they know about themselves. We had a guest a few weeks ago, and we replayed it as an encore a few weeks ago. David McRaney. Years ago, I wrote an aphorism called The Delusion, Hide the Delusion. And I started thinking in the area of field systems. That's what none of these people that are writing this changing images of man and all this, they're only writing things to ensnare people into a way of a management of people through new ideas. You must be released from these ideas that are seemingly the answer to everything. And the only way that you can do that, the battle line, like Solzhenitsyn said, runs through the human heart. It's self-responsibility. It's beginning to see how wrong that you have been and the transgressions that you committed against others. And it's a coming out of that state, a change of direction. But only you can do it. It's not about accepting some new movement and some new leader. Krishnamurti disbanded his movement in the 20s in the Netherlands and said, go get out of here. All you people are following me. Are you crazy? It's not about some new guru that has some new great answer. It's about individuals taking responsibility for themselves. And the greatest of all divine teachings is forgiveness. In that state, in that beginning state of walking and beginning to walk in a spirit of forgiving is when you can begin to come out. Nobody's going to do it for you. And no other man can do it but yourself. There are dominant images of humankind throughout history in Table 3 in this white paper called Changing Images of Man. And I'm going to read you off some of those basic ideas throughout the ages. And they go back to the Industrial Revolution and come forward, okay? And let's see what... Well, they go further back than that. Let's go back here. They go to Middle Paleolithic. Okay, man, that's 250,000 years ago, okay? What they say about the image of man then was the hunter focus of the male-dominated culture. Field of the Great Hunt, okay? And so that's basically how they jeopardizes the cross-cultural peace. May be necessary for police operations, they say, though. You see what I mean? So they're saying here that this image of man being the great hunter, oh, that's good for police operations. Oh, that's great. Now, the second one is Upper Paleolithic, and you can download this off the website and start, you know, looking at this chart yourself. It's table number 3, and it's entitled Dominant Images of Humankind Throughout History. The next source period, and they go through these source periods and sort of describe it in this chart from left to right. The Upper Paleolithic was 30,000 B.C. to 15,000 B.C. It included a sense of spiritual affinity between beast and man, of which totemism is an expression. Okay? It manifested in various American Indian cultures with traditional. Okay? It has relevance for a renewed sense of partnership with other life forms on the planet. So they're going to go out here and use totemism to, you know, mesmerize us also. Okay, let's go to the next one, Neolithic. This is after 9,000 B.C. This is when man became the agriculturist, the farmer, the planter, the child of the goddess woman, the giver of life. The Hindu and certain other cultures is about 9,000 B.C. forward. They say here the significance of it, it has possible relevance for balancing male emphasis of Western culture. Okay? So there, they're wanting to bring forward the goddess idea and balance this overburdening dominant male, you know, with this new goddess idea. The Sumerian, 3500 B.C., the human civilized through submission to seasonal variations and ruling elites. It says most cultures in the present, and it says has relevance as historical analogy shows political function of new images. Okay. Semite, 2350 B.C., the human as a mere creature fashioned of clay to serve the gods or some god as a slave, but superior to and having dominion over nature, notion of chosen people. Well, they're saying here that the Orthodox Jewish Christian Islamic faith has set that out. Now, here's what they say about that. It stands in its present form as an obstacle to emergence of new ecological understandings. Okay? So that's why the attack on these faiths is underway right now, because it'll keep them from bringing about this new emerging image of man, see? And then this new emerging image of man will be easier to control through the media they already own and everything else. Zoroastrianism, okay? We're looking there at 1200 B.C., the human having free will, having to choose between good and evil, mythology of individual salvation. It's all Western cultures in a secular form. It presents a basic polarity needing to be diametrically transcended or synthesized is what it's saying here. So they're not totally sold on that being, you know, that good for what they're all about right now. Age of the Polis, 500 B.C., India, one deluded by Maya, the Buddha, representing the absolute fulfillment of the Indian image, Hindu Buddhism. It could contribute to a new self-realization ethic for our culture, okay? And that's basically what they're saying about that particular period, okay? Now, the next source period would be the Middle Paleolithic. Let's get back here to this chart. Okay. Is it getting interesting? I hope this is not too boring for you out there, because there's so much to talk about after you even look at this chart and start thinking about it, you know? Okay, we've got Age of the Polis. Let's see. Let's go to the next one then. Let's see. Okay. Early Christian and Muslim, they're saying they're for the time 100 A.D. to 622 A.D. That's when Muhammad established Islam in 622 A.D. And they're saying here two contrary imaging following these Semite and Zoroastrian traditions: God's servant, obey or be damned; that of the Gnostics, similar to the image of the Greek mystery religions, the person saved by self knowledge. Okay, they're describing these as traditional Judeo-Christian Muslim cultures, most cultures as an underground view. a dominant image that needs to be incorporated into a larger synthesis. So that's what they're all about, is taking some of these older Christian views and incorporating those into some new larger synthesis. Could contribute to a new self-realization ethic for our culture, okay? Are incorporated into a larger synthesis. Okay. Now, let's get up to more contemporary times here with this. The Industrial Revolution, and they're saying Enlightenment, 1500 A.D., economic man, individualistic, materialistic, rationalistic, objective knowledge, utilitarian, economic values coming into dominance. That's the dominant image. Most modern industrial nations today are what they're saying. This can be described in this way. Likely inappropriate for transition to post-industrial era, see? Okay? The next one, modern social science, 1900 A.D. Human as a beast, instinctual drives predominant, a creature of evolution whose survival depends on competitive adaptation and or suppression of basic instincts. They're saying most modern industrial nations today. An image needing to be incorporated into a larger synthesis. Okay? Modern Behavioral Science, 1913 A.D., human as mechanism to be understood in ways found success. This is behaviorism they're describing here. Okay, human as mechanism to be understood in ways found successful by 19th century physics, primarily United States, they're saying. Promoted as providing the most appropriate basis for man's next era, perhaps now itself needing to be incorporated into larger synthesis. They keep saying larger synthesis all the time, don't they? So, you know, they're not satisfied with what's going on right now. They want to create this new world order, this new image of man, right? Okay, modern transdisciplinary science, 1945 A.D., human as a goal-directed adaptive learning system. Image has not yet reached takeoff point. And then it says, provides a possible conceptual basis for integrating more other images of man in an evolutionary frame of reference. Frame of reference. Now, that gets back to some of the neuro-linguistic programming. You create frame. They create these frames and that we're inside of, right? And then we have to think within the frame, right? Okay, various times and places from circa 1500 B.C. to the present. Here they're saying human as spirit. The Philosophia Perennis view of man and the universe as essentially consciousness in manifest form, most cultures in various degrees of purity, could contribute to needed synthesis of opposing images as it sees apparent opposites as differing aspects of the same underlying philosophy. Okay. Now, with that said, you begin to understand that this thing wasn't put out there just to, you know what I mean, not to be taken seriously. This was read in the 70s, early 70s, by some of the intellectual greats of all time in the country and not the world. And so they're taking this seriously, and you can see it, this being transformed. One of the biggest transformational agents is the Aspen Institute of Humanistic Studies out in Aspen, Colorado. If you go out there, multiculturalism, all this other stuff. But it's all divisive. It's not really bringing us together. It's to divide us into little groups and tribal. Yeah, it's pushing tribalism almost. On page 62 of this Changing Images of Men, there is something in here that I found pretty interesting. It's called the American Creed. Let's see what Gunnar Myrdal from Sweden says about the American creed here. It says, here's what he said. We conclude this highly selective survey of important images of humankind by inquiring what images were most important in the formation of the United States. In his classical study of black-white relations in the United States and American Dilemma, the Swedish social scientist Gunnar Myrdal, 1945, was struck particularly by the near unanimous national endorsement of a coherent body of beliefs, of values, an image of humankind whose characteristics he had termed the American Creed. This is what he says in his book. America, compared to every other country in Western civilization, large or small, has the most explicitly expressed system of general ideals, ideals in reference to human interrelations. This body of ideals is more widely understood and appreciated than similar ideals are anywhere else. And then he goes on to say, the basic character and pervasive application of the American Creed were spelled out by Myerdal in one sweeping paragraph. Here's what he says. These ideas of the essential dignity of the individual human being, individual, not group here, of the fundamental equality of all men and of certain inalienable rights to freedom, justice, and a fair opportunity represent to the American people the essential meaning of the nation's early struggle for independence. In the clarity and intellectual boldness of the Enlightenment period, these tenets were written into the Declaration of Independence. Well, Myerdal, you said it right. I'll tell you that. So even within this changing images of man that is being used as a mechanism to change us and change this country, they stayed in there some very, very beautiful things. He goes on to say the preamble of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and to the constitutions of the several states, the ideals of the American Creed have thus become the highest law of the land. This is what he wrote in 1945, Myerdal. Gunnar Myerdal, Swedish sociologist. The Supreme Court pays its reverence to these general principles when it declares what is constitutional and what is not. They have been elaborated upon by all national leaders, thinkers, and statesmen. America has had, throughout its history, a continuous discussion of the principles and implications of democracy, a discussion which in every epoch, measured by any standard, remained high, not only quantitatively, but qualitatively. The flow of learned treatises and popular tracts on the subject has not ebbed, nor is it likely to do so. In all wars, including the present one, the American Creed has taken the ideological foundation of national morale. He wrote this in 1945, which is right at the end of World War II, so that's what he's alluding to there in that last sentence. Now, even within this white paper on changing images of man that they're trying to get us... Boy, that struck me. This is the first time that I was researching and reviewing this today, and I said, my gosh, I had not noticed this. I had read it before, but not in that great a detail. I went down and dug in and drilled down into this thing and came up with this today, and my gosh, it really is a beautiful tribute to the United States. When you look at what's going on in the world today, and especially the United States, it's very sad and disheartening. It's sad and disheartening because, just like Myerdal said, Gunnar Myerdal said, in his writings in 1945, the Americans have the most explicit system statement of ideals of any nation in the world. American exceptionalism was the idea that we should teach this to all the other nations in the world. And that's what I really still believe. I do not subscribe to the fact that we should develop some new world order idea that's slave thinking. I have to get back to the American ideals, like Gunnar Myerdal just stated in some of these writings here that I just stated on radio here. So, Gunnar Myerdal knew in 1945, well, what's happened since then? Well, we've had a takeover in 1913 of our money system. We've had a tremendous... control over all business through that money creation, and it's a monopoly of money creation. That is really what has been the key controlling mechanism. So when you start looking at that, and then you say, oh my gosh, they brought these, they feed these ideas at the Aspen and the Council on Foreign Relations, Trilateral, and all these other things. On a recent paper that I did, and you can find that at the top of thesecrettruth.com, it's called The Egyptian Plantation. And in my research in there, I'm continuously updating it a little bit, and my latest update came about was yesterday. And I found another paper that was insightful, and basically what happened was when Nasser passed away from a heart attack in 1970, well, Sadat, Anwar Sadat, took over as president. And so he began to try to put forward a new idea, a new reform movement, and it just didn't go over. But in doing that, he sought the he turned away from the Soviet influence, of military influence and equipment, to American military equipment and assistance. Nasser had turned to the Soviet Union when he took over and started using their equipment and their help, their aid, military aid. While when Anwar Sadat came in, he started cozying up to the United States, and eventually we got him in there to make peace with Israel. And of course, there were many Islamists, extreme radical Islamists, in there in the army, and they finally had a review of the army. They stopped an armored personnel carrier, and I think it was Wheeled, this one, and came out the back and shot him dead there in the stands, in the reviewing stands. So Egypt, boy, it's something else, isn't it? But in reviewing that, there were two men that influenced him, and the two were David Rockefeller and William Simon. And what basically they did, they influenced him to take on more debt from the IMF and more international relations and more. They began to influence him, persuade him into trying to develop, you know, jobs and so forth, taking in for more outside investment, see. Nasser had created over there something that was diametrically opposed to what we believe in. It was more on the socialist side. And in doing that, then they created a very large bureaucracy. But anyway, so when we get back to looking at these great papers, say, Changing Images of Man, and these other great pronouncements about how the world can be a better place through a higher consciousness, well, the higher consciousness has to be a higher consciousness of self. I don't see it, because there's always this ego state, and it influences and it gets in the way. It's obstructive of being able to see oneself. So in this ego state, it's increasingly difficult to see oneself, and we can begin to see as we grow older. In the young state that we find ourselves, the young men, the young women, they're driven by, especially by material and so forth, and ideas that continue to build that ego state. Only when you grow a little bit older can you reflect back on and trying to accept what's wrong with you, you know, on what, you know, sort of had a family that had an alcoholic father, and that didn't bode well for us in the family. Only afterward did we begin to appreciate what that did, and then we had to overcome some of the problems that were inherent in that conditioning and those kinds of states, family rows and fights and stuff like that. Not physical, just psychological and so forth. But then you begin to say, well, I'm an individual, I'm an adult. Yeah, I went through a family like that, but by God, if you hate people for what they did to you like that, then you're trapped. And that's where forgiveness comes in. When you can begin to truly forgive your family, your dad, who was quite a drinker, and I've forgiven him, then you can begin to really come out of it and lead a new life. It's a new way. It's a new direction. So that's what Charlotte Littlefield and I have been on this air for nearly 7 years about, is that we're trying to create, and you know, we're not trying to be the big, you know, leader of anything. We're not creating any kind of a cult. You don't sign up and come to our meetings and bow down to us or anything that we say. But what we're telling people or professing to tell them is freedom. When you can begin to forgive, you can begin the path to real freedom. It's not cultic, it's anti-cultic. To forgive kills cults, is a cult killer. That's why the assault on those ideas by the Satanist or whoever, you know, the occultist, let's say, has been very great. They can't control people that love one another. You can control people that hate one another by feeding both sides with arms and manipulations of ideas and then, you know, sic them on each other like mad dogs. And that's basically what we've, you know, been undergoing. And now we're going to, the answer is robotics that this Ray Kurzweil is putting forward. Are you kidding me? We're going to somehow build into the human and make the human more robotic, and then we're going to be a machine, right? Well, who wants to do that? What we have never taught on a wide scale the real human dilemma, and we need to get back to those simple things of loving thy neighbor and so forth, love, forgiveness, and so forth. But instead, we go out here and we teach all of these amazingly intricate, you know, knowledge-based systems of physics and so forth. But we don't really teach people why they're educational institutions. And those institutions aren't out there to free us. They're out there to condition us into a state with definitions and ideas and concepts and theories that we can be more easily manipulated with by the control and manipulation of those theories and idea based. It's a set. In mathematics, you have a series of numbers, and you have a set that is called a set. So in this system of social synergy that is visited on us, there are sets out there of knowledge then. And those sets of knowledge that have been taught to us and downstream to us and placed into our minds. And so we've integrated into our minds a certain set theory, see? And so if somebody from the university, or let's just say someone, you know, from the public out there has anything that's contrary to, well, then they're a nutcase, or they're a conspiratorial nut, or they don't know what they're doing, and they're kind of crazy. But what and who has been in charge are the real nutcases. To try to implement a build down a population that is planned and a system of corporate fascism that is underway and a great has to be being carried out by the most diabolical of minds, much less the most psychopathic characters you're ever going to meet. So the psychopaths that exist out there are at the very top of this pyramid. They believe that they are God, see, and they're going to teach us on what to do and how to do it. And so we must succumb to their papers like the Changing Images Man and believe that, or we must see the Joseph Campbell and believe that that is some great new insight that we didn't have before. Yeah, it's one thing I did learn from Joseph Campbell, and not that it can't be helpful. I'm not saying that some of his research and stuff cannot be helpful today. It's helpful, all right, because they put a new myth on us called the 9/11 myth. Yeah. So the Greeks, manipulators, the people that dominated their society, they used the myth then, back in Greek times, to manipulate the masses and the low people, the low classes. So are they not manipulating us with the 9/11 Attack on America myth. See, it's the same thing. It's just from a different group, but a very diabolical one. Then it was from a group that dominated the philosophical, religious teachings of that day. And today, it's our politicians that use over and over terrorism and the attack on America. And they, because Americans have been transformed and you could say trauma-based programmed by that attack on the World Trade Center, then it's a very powerful tool to influence them and to use them. So we must wake up that one myth in Greek times was used to control people, and then the modern 9/11 myth today is used to control us. We must come out of that. We must see that Building 7 came down like an implosion late in the day, that day. We must look around the Pentagon and see that there's no plane parts there. There's no airplane parts. We must begin to come out of these mythological systems of thought and stand outside and see these myths for what they are. The Greek people, the poor people of Greece, they had these great leaders, and these great leaders were telling them about these great Zeus stories and this and that. So they could only believe what they were being told, because the people in charge, the wealthy of the society that had the grandest of robes and the grandest of clothing and robes and standings in the society, and the greatest, highest level politicians of their days and the great philosophers and teachers of their days were teaching the poor people about Zeus and, oh, you got to bow down and this story and that story. So they were, through storytelling, they were dominating the poor people of Greece. Then are they not storytelling us about 9/11 and dominating us too? We've got to come out of this 9/11 mythology, because if not, we're going to lose this country. It is the most important, I've said this before, that it is the most important, most evil, insidious act ever committed against the United States by insiders of the United States. That is the key to seeing this. Go study it. Get photographs of the Pentagon. Go look at Building 7 and see it come down late in the day. We've got to wake up to the fact of what's really going on and begin to come out of this state of mesmerized, mind-washed, traumatized existence that we have come to exist in. A little lost for words there. I'm getting a little tired on this first hour. But anyway, so wake up out there, you know, become more and better informed. And all I can say is we're going to end this first hour. We're going to come back with current news. We're going to cover some of that Snowden stuff. This stuff up the Harp, he's saying that it's an assassination tool. First time I've ever heard that. I can't totally agree with that. But Nick Baggage up in Alaska says otherwise. He says it's done a lot of other things, but maybe not that. But anyway, we're going to come back and cover that in just a few minutes. But stay with us and listen to the second hour. Thank you for listening, and good night.